Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, March 17th. I'm Ray Graff. Mark Lawson of Albany's Mark Lawson Antiques, Jewelry, and Coins is on the line today to answer your questions. And on the St. Patrick's Day, we'll talk a little about some Irish antiques today, and who knows what else. If you've recently uncovered a hidden treasure, you need help figuring out what it is, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Mark Lawson, your antique questions coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're discussing antiques today with Mark Lawson of Albany's Mark Lawson Antiques, Jewelry, and Coin. Mark has been buying, selling, and collecting stuff since he was 8 years old. After running a traditional antique shop and opening a gallery on Broadway in Saratoga, Mark was approached by Sotheby's in 2000 to assist organizing and curating single-owner sales. Mark is a past member of the American Society of Appraisers and has completed courses in the NYU Appraisal Studies Program in Period American Furniture at the Metropolitan Museum. He's also certified in diamond grading from the Gemological Institute of America, an RPI grad with a degree in materials engineering. Mark travels throughout the region meeting with clients, helping them settle estates and family treasures. You got a question? Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Mark Lawson, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be here, Ray. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
And also with you, my friend. Now, you sent a few items, some pictures, which, by the way, you can see on our webpage. Just go to wamc.org/voxpop and bring up today's program. You have some Irish-related antiques to talk about.
We do. We're currently selling for a client at auction a wonderful collection of silver from the British Isles, much of it from the 18th and 19th century, which included a beautiful big Irish sterling silver sugar caster. It's a big sugar shaker for sprinkling sugar on your desserts, dating from 1880 or so. It's just a beautiful piece of handmade silver from Ireland. And because of the green, I also sent along a picture of a beautiful 23-carat sugarloaf emerald. Ooh. Which is a beautiful antique stone and a glorious Irish green.
Why do they call it a sugarloaf?
Because the shape is similar to the loaves that refined sugar was formed into for shipment up in, at the sugar plantations up until the 19th century.
Ah, okay. And again, you can see these on our website, wamc.org/voxpop. Just bring up today's program and you will see them. Now, you mentioned that this sugar shaker, this Irish silver sugar shaker, is a big item. How big is that? You can't tell from the picture.
Well, I mean, big to a sugar shaker aficionado, I guess. It's 7 or 8 inches tall, and very often, more common ones you see might be, 3 or 4 inches tall. So as sugar shakers go, it's a giant, but to somebody that didn't know anything about sugar shakers, it's not particularly large.
No, I mean, it almost looks like a cocktail shaker. But I think the cocktail would come out of the holes at the top, so probably wouldn't work too well. Now, there is a bell among the pictures that you sent.
Oh, yeah. That's so so interesting and wonderful. So I had the family, descendants of the family that the Water Velite Shaker community sold the Water Velite Shaker property and buildings to back in the 1940s, brought me there the bell that sat on top of the bell house at the Water Velite Shaker community. It was made in 1848 in West Troy, which is now Water Velite. by, you know, one of the foremost makers, Manili, of bronze bells in the United States. So it's the original bell that the Shakers purchased then, and it called, it rang, and multiple times a day calling the Shakers to, you know, their daily activities and devotions. So a really, really wonderful piece of local history.
We're joined today by Mark Lawson of Mark Lawson Antiques, Jewelry, and Coin. If you have a question about anything antique you might have lurking in the attic or wherever, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. This Shaker bell, how do you know it's 1848? Is there a date inside?
It's marked right on the company Manili typically dated their bells when they were cast. So it's clearly marked right up on the band going around the top.
Very cool. And then you also had a beautiful set of English silver, which goes back to the 1700s.
Nice, 1752 set of English sterling silver dining plates. Very unusual to find a complete set of 12 in the pristine condition that these are in, from, you know, the mid 18th century. You know, it is uncommon for any kind of precious metal objects to survive that long. You know, either they were turned into something that more people were interested in having, or, you know, the melted down just for their silver value, so, you know, people could get some money. But part of a great collection that we're currently handling that is really fine and rare.
Now, the picture shows clearly gleaming silver. We know silver will tarnish, and one of the things, and maybe it's wrong, that I have heard is, oh, you got the old silver, never put that silver polish on that stuff, it'll ruin the value. But this stuff looks perfect.
Yeah, well, that's so with silver polishing, there's a couple of things. It can be polished safely. You always want to use a jeweler's polish that is pink in color. It has jeweler's rouge in it, and there's nothing like there's an unmistakable patina that good silver acquires after decades or centuries of loving hand polishing. So it's absolutely okay to do that, but you don't want to overdo it. On the other hand, the one where there is a distinct problem are the silver dips. You know, like you put baking soda in a solution with, you know, some aluminum foil, and you dip the silver in there, and then the tarnish magically disappears. It's very handy. The problem is that process takes off a microscopic layer of everything. So not only do you remove the tarnish, but you remove some silver too, and over time that'll cause the silver to be pitted and lose its value. And it also leaves to the educated eye of a connoisseur is a harsh surface that and again the advanced silver collectors really look for the wonderful warm glowing patina that only many years of a careful hand polish can achieve.
Very interesting. So when you look at a set of silver and silver plates or silverware, and oftentimes on this program you said, oh, you got a nice set of silverware. That's terrific. It's not worth all that much more than the silver. But when you when you look at something like that, you'll know immediately, oh, yeah, these were dipped.
Not so much with that, because the kind of patina that we're talking is really in antique silver. So that patination that builds up over time, and a connoisseur, you know, carefully appreciating that's more for silver that's 150 or 200 or 300 years old. For modern silver, that is silver that was commercially produced from maybe the late 19th century on, there really hasn't, it's silver that's mass-produced commercially, there really isn't the same kind of connoisseurship And, you know, there's not much of the real connoisseurship left anymore. Most of those people, God bless them, are gone. But the with mass-produced silver, that kind of consideration really doesn't come into play. And frankly, if you showed me a set of modern silver that had been dipped versus hand-polished, I couldn't tell the difference. So, so not so much with mass-produced silver. Those considerations are only for the older things. However, the dipping will still, over time, slowly destroy silver. So whether it's modern silver or antique silver. So usually that's something that you want to avoid.
Mark Lawson is our guest today. It's Antiques on this St. Patrick's Day. 800-348-2551 if you have an antique question. Doesn't have to be Irish antiques, any kind, Lithuanian, whatever you got. 800-348-2551. And the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Box Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is the number. Mark Lawson is with us today via the telephone, and we talk antiques. I got to tell you, for Christmas, my wife got me the best gift ever. It was a metal detector. And
cool.
We went out. It's a pretty good one. And we went out back. We had one nice day before it snowed after Christmas, and, you know, it's a showed up dime. And I said, okay, yeah, right, okay. Well, it was a 1943 Mercury dime, and it was down about 6 inches. And when we get an old coin like that, if I find a silver quarter or whatever, because it's been snowy since then, now it's finally melted, we're going to go out again, I shouldn't dip those. I should leave them as is, right?
Although if it's been buried for a long time, there's probably not a whole lot you could do to hurt the value.
Yeah.
The modern 20th century coinage like that, and the trade is called junk silver. Its only value really is the silver value, although the designs are beautiful, and it's certainly exciting to find one with a metal detector.
Yeah.
You really don't have to worry about the with those coins, the only condition that's going to be matter is if it's in exceptional, pristine condition, just like it came off the press at the mint.
So what you're saying is my wife's gift is really not that nice, is what you're trying to tell me.
No. Just the right next to that 1943 could be a really nice 1916D that even buried is going to be worth, you know, hundreds, you know, possibly more than $1,000.
Have you ever tried the metal detecting? It is a blast.
Yeah, I loved it, and I got my 15-year-old son, Gabriel, is also fallen in love with that, and he goes out on the beach where we go on vacation and comes home with remarkable collections of all sorts of stuff and finds lots of garbage, too.
Yeah, I bet you will. This email came in from Martha. Oh, this is along the same lines. Martha writes, can you tell me how to find out the value of old coins, specifically a 1966 silver Kennedy half dollar and a 1922 Liberty dollar? I have other old coins that belong to my father, but have no idea where to go to find out their value. And that's from Martha.
There's lots and lots of resources online to sort out the values for things like that. There's the Red Book and Blue Book are two of the publications that publish for collectors values, although they may not reflect what the actual cash value is. It's more along the lines of, you know, what you can expect to pay if you're a collector buying that sort of thing. A 66 Kennedy half dollar is made out of 40% silver. Doesn't have any collectible value, but today it's worth, you know, between $3 and $4 for the 40% silver that's in it.
Yeah.
The 1922 peace dollar, another common date, silver dollars of all types, 1935 and before, even when they're common, because they're collectible coins and fun to sell and affordable, they usually sell for a premium above their silver content. But that for the common ones, that premium is just based on what the condition is.
Okay. This email from Peggy, and then we'll get to the phones, 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Mark Lawson, Peggy writes, can you recommend brass polish?
Well, I don't know. For brass polish, I grew up using Brasso. I remember going out on the one house we lived in. There was a brass railing on the steps going down to the basement. And while I dreaded that job, it seems to me, I recall that the Brasso did a reasonably good job. For silver, what's the industry standard is a product called Simichrome, which is a good quality, very good quality jeweler's rouge type silver polish. You could probably use it on brass, but it's going to be a lot more expensive than Brasso.
Now, why does it have to have a rouge to it?
I think that, so rouge is a very fine jeweler's abrasive that's used to get a really fine high luster on a piece of silver or gold. And so, one, it's indicative of something that's going to give you a nice shine, but it's also something that's a little bit more expensive. So anything with some rouge in it is, that, to me, gives me confidence that it's a better quality product, not just some, you know, something that you may or may not want to, that is undefined and you may or may not want to put on your silver or gold.
Mark Lawson joins us today. It's Antiques on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. Anne in Walden. Anne, you're on.
Hi. I have an antique Louis Vuitton steamer trunk. It's the wardrobe. It's got the hangers and the drawers and everything.
Nice.
That my mother bought at an estate sale probably 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, about 25 years ago, she said, this will pay for my daughter's graduate school. I know it won't do that, but I'm wondering how much it's worth and where I could sell it.
So those are any kind of Louis Vuitton luggage is highly collectible, highly sought after, and, you know, mainly, number one, it's a status. It's a status kind of accessory.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been into one of the Louis Vuitton retail shops, you know, any time in the last 10 or 20 years, but, you know, very, very expensive. And the quality is unsurpassed. The antique pieces are highly sought after, mainly as, I think, as decorative objects. And again, with that kind of status cachet, it's going to be worth at least, you know, the in not too good condition, you know, there's certainly worth, you know, in the minimum in the $5,000 to $10,000 range.
Wow.
And for one that's really, really nice, it could be, you know, much more than that. I'm just trying to take a quick look at auction records to see. Yeah, so here's one. You know, they can go north of $20,000.
Wow.
Today if they're in nice condition.
Nice.
This one is in excellent condition. The only issue is one of the handles has broken off, but I actually have the piece.
Oh.
Good. So hang on to all the pieces mm-hmm. that you may not get quite the very highest price, but you're still going to be in the five figures range for something like that. And it'll generate a lot of interest, something that will be relatively easy to sell for a very good price.
And way to start the show. That's a good one.
Yep.
800-348-2551, the number. Mark Lawson joins us today. Neil in Pine Bush. Hello, Neil. You're on.
Hi. So So you kind of answered my question while you were just talking, but my father, turns out after he passed, we found out that he was, you know, he's told us these racing stories. Turns out he was actually a legit race car driver and used to win at Daytona and so on and so forth, but this is back in the 70s. And they used to hand out silver bowls and silver platters, like 20-inch silver platters. And I don't want to get rid of it. I just want to know how to take care of it, because at this point it's patinaed, like, to the point where it's like charcoal gray. And yeah. I was listening to you with Simichrome.
Yeah, Simichrome. That's the best product. That's where I would. That's what I would recommend.
Okay. Should I leave it patinaed or should I polish it up?
Once it forms a really thick oxide level, like it sounds like it has, it's probably reasonably stable. It will, you know, slowly over time continue to degrade to some degree, but it's probably not going to get an awful lot worse. And it probably shouldn't lose more of its value than it's already lost through the tarnishing. With pieces like that, it depends. You know, sometimes if it was made out of silver plate, which is usually an electroplated layer of silver over copper nickel or like a brass material. If it tarnishes too much, it'll eat up the layer of silver. So, you know, you don't want it to get to that point. And unfortunately, it'll be hard to know what it looks like for sure underneath the tarnish till you have it all removed. It will, if it's black, though, I know from hard-won experience, it's going to take a bit of elbow grease to get it off of there. You may want to test polish a little spot on the back or something. You can get a tube of Simichrome for $10 or $15. You know, go online, buy a tube, and test polish a spot and see what it looks like, and then you'll know. Also, you'll have a clue the investment of time that you may have to put in.
All right, fair enough.
Hey,
I'm pretty sure. I don't think they were the electroplated kind, because maybe Tiffany Company made them.
Wow,
they're stamped on the back, but I'm just not. They're going to be family heirlooms that I pass to my kids.
Sure,
I just want to keep them protected. That's all.
At that time period, if they were made out of solid silver by Tiffany, they would have been required by law to be marked with the word sterling. So you can look for that.
Yeah, they say sterling. They say sterling.
Okay, so there you go. So they're solid silver. Don't have to worry about silver plate.
Okay.
Hey, Neil, just before you go, your father won at Daytona and you didn't know?
So, well, I guess when I was born, my mom made him quit racing, is the long or the short story, you know. But he won the 24 hours of Daytona in 70, 72. He placed second, you know, like he did. And they raced all over. It turns out he knew somebody named John Gimble, you know, like Macy's and Gimble.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were partners in a race team.
Like, you know, this is amazing, man. And you know what? Your mom had the power to say, no, you got a kid now, you're done. So God bless her, and God bless you and your dad, and thank you for calling. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's go to Ellen in Pittsfield. Hello, Ellen.
Hello there. I have some jewelry from my mother who died a long time ago, and I'm wondering, I don't use it, and it's just sitting there. So I'm wondering, if I were to try to sell it, I don't know what it's worth. Some of it is gold. How would I know where to get the best price, and where should I take it?
Yeah, I like... One of the things I love about the internet is the ability and the way that they have built a structure of reviewing businesses. So the one place to start is look on you know, you can do a Google search. You know, if you do a Google search for people who buy jewelry, you're going to get most at the top of the list. You're going to get the people that pay the most to advertise, not necessarily the most reliable people. So look for some people locally that are convenient to you, and go and just search their names on Google. And on the right hand side of the screen, the business should come up, and with reviews. And that's a place to start. Look at the reviews. Read the reviews. Everybody gets some bad reviews. Look at the way they've responded to negative ones, if they have, and that'll give you a clue. I also like, you know, like many people, when I'm looking for somebody to do business with, some sort of service firm, I like referrals from friends or family that have had experience with them. So there's nothing like a firsthand referral from somebody that's actually been to the place and had an experience and can talk to you about that. And if it's a close personal friend or a family member, you have some confidence in what they're saying, and you know the whether you should take what they're saying with a grain of salt or not. So I think those would be the two number one things I would keep in mind when trying to do what you're doing.
Okay, thank you.
Ellen, you're very welcome.
Thanks a lot for the call. Mark Lawson of Mark Lawson Antiques, Jewelry and Coin joins us today. 800-348-2551 is the number. Richard is in Poughkeepsie. Hello there, Richard.
Hey there. I just had a simple question. You've talked about silver a lot today. And I understand that if you don't keep your silver pieces polished, I've inherited some, that they'll become pitted. So I guess I'd like you to talk about what pitted is and how to avoid it. And then I'd like to ask, if you have something that's badly tarnished, does it make any sense to just take it to a fine jewelry store and let them do it? And that's all my questions. I'll just listen.
Okie-do.
Yeah, any kind of silver as it tarnishes, if it tarnishes enough, can become pitted depending on the nature of the corrosion and what's initiating it. Like a lot from the, it used to be, I'm not so sure with emissions, it's still the a factor to the same degree, but it used to be that, you know, gas burning engines put out lots of sulfur dioxide, and it was the sulfur dioxide in the air that would tarnish, that could tarnish silver. If anybody lives in a house that has sulfur water, they know very well that the fumes from the sulfur water will cause the silver in the house to tarnish much more quickly and to a greater degree. So it really depends, you know, and so the agents that can initiate that or accelerate that process will, what they are and to what degree they cause something to a piece of silver to tarnish will be a factor in whether they pit or not. I'm not familiar with, if you just have silver wrapped up in a silver cloth sitting in a drawer, I think it may sit there for hundreds of years before it pits, if it ever does. But on the other hand, if it gets into it comes into an environment where that process is accelerated because of, you know, whatever's in the air or whatever, you know, corrosive liquid comes in contact with it, then absolutely that can happen. And as I spoke before, if you're, you know, dipping silver to remove tarnish, you're actually doing using a strong electrochemical process to remove the top layer in a piece of silver, and that will, you know, in done over and over in a relatively short period of time, cause some pitting to begin happening. So there's that. I hope that answers that part of the question. I think it's going to be fine just in a drawer in a silver cloth. The part with, what was the other part of the question?
I lost track a long time ago. You still there, Richard? No, Richard.
Yeah,
okay,
I am.
There he is.
Could you send it to a fine jeweler to have them buff it?
There are probably
little black spots because
Yeah, those, I know those black spots, they're tough to get out. I'm familiar with them. You absolutely could. There aren't that many. There are fewer and fewer full-service jewelers that'll offer those kind of services because people are so much less interested in sterling silver today. So there's not much business in it. I formerly have referred people many times to Mayfair Jewelers. It's a nice family-run business. They were in Glenville on Glen Ridge Road. Their main place is still there, and I think they have a satellite store down on the Latham Circle. Nice people. John and Victor Sosnowski still run it, second generation. They took over from their dad, and they used to offer services like that. I don't know if they still do, but they're decent people, and I would trust their referral if they couldn't do it and refer you someplace. And then there's always Google, you know. Yeah. Google is your friend to a degree.
Yeah.
with a grain of salt. I just don't take everything you read to heart completely without, you know, double checking it a little bit first.
Right. It's your frenemy, really. The number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Mark Lawson joins us. Antiques. More questions coming up. Fox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. It's Antiques Today with Mark Lawson of Mark Lawson Antiques Jewelry and Coin. The number is 800-348-2551. And Mark, a few emails here, and then we'll go back to the phones. This one's from Jim. I don't know if he's putting us on. Jim says, I have a 1920s double eagle gold coin. I don't think it's very rare. Probably only worth the gold it contains. How much gold by weight and value in one of these?
The gold coins minted for circulation in the United States were always 90% gold, you know, which is, I don't know, 21.6 carat. The so by weight of 90% gold, they're a little bit over an ounce, and their adjusted gross weight, their AGW weight is a little under 1 ounce, you know, 0.96 something something of pure gold. So the a double eagle has a little bit less than an ounce of pure gold in it. And the caller's exactly right for, other than a few rare dates in, you know, exceptionally high condition, the value today is just going to be the derived from the gold value. Although in Alaska, we have seen in the marketplace in the last couple of months, I guess, you know, I don't know if it's a fallout from this whole, you know, Reddit thing and GameStop. And,
yeah,
you know,
okay.
So you have this whole new population of young gamers that have discovered investing as a game, and so they drove up the GameStop. They started pumping silver, which I think was part of an increase in the silver price over the last couple of months, and that may have drifted over into gold. So there are some nice premiums today on the gold. So I think depending on what it is, you can, you know, find anywhere from, just because there's a higher demand, they're anywhere from, you know, 5 to 15% premiums on what you can get for the common gold coins that were not that, you know, 6 months ago, a year ago, just, you know, you could buy for just you would only be able to sell for about the melt value. Another factor in this, I think, is that people are really concerned about all the quantitative easing going on,
sure.
All the money that's, you know, we have a monetary system where we, you know, issue debt to create more money, and the level to which that has been done over the last year with trying to respond to the pandemic is unprecedented, really. So I think there's some concerns about inflation coming down the road and more of a demand for a traditional inflation hedge like gold.
Mm-hmm. And what's gold an ounce now? I mean, even if it's the most common 20s double eagle, it's worth what, a thou? Something more than $1,000?
Let's see, right this second, it's $1,745.70.
Okay, that'll get you a couple of Arby's, right? This is from Diane in Worcester. Diane says, I have a large oil painting of a forest scene. Uh-oh, my Dutch isn't too good here. Signed, De Stijge. It's from my great aunt's antique shop in Brittany back in the 40s or 50s. I don't know the date. The spelling is D-E, capital S-T-I-J-S. Is there any way to find information on this artist? I assume it's a Dutch name, and that's from Diane in Worcester, New York.
If they wanted to, you know, send an image of the painting and a close-up of the signature, I'd be happy to look at that. That's certainly a Dutch spelling. I have nothing under that. I have like the big Davenport is a great reference. Paper reference with, you know, the most of the known listed artists. I think it's got, you know, tens of thousands, maybe 100,000.
Okay.
320,000 artists. So I get nothing with that spelling in Davenport, which is like kind of the traditional first go-to. You could go the next level up and get a 30-volume edition of Benezet, which is the European art reference, and there's probably millions of artists in that one. But anyway, it's hard to make out what the name is, so
yeah.
The spelling may not be right. And even if the artist is known and is in the reference books, sometimes they get into the reference books with the wrong spelling. So you have to kind of do a little bit of detecting and look around for similar spellings to try and find your way there. But it can be searching for a needle in a haystack. But if anybody, it doesn't have to be me, anybody that's knowledgeable can take a look at an image of the picture, and based on how competently it's made, you know, give you an indication of whether it's whether it's likely to yield, you know, some good results,
right,
if you identify it.
So you can tell your Matisse from your Kincaid pretty well, is what
Matisse and Kincaid, yes,
okay,
for sure.
All right, let's go to Linda in the Berkshires. Linda, you're on.
Hi. I was a collector, and I actually managed to look in my jewelry box and found what I would call a medal. It is 1 inch by 1 inch, and I couldn't quite read it because it was a little on the dirty side. So I brought it to my jeweler, and I just picked it up a few minutes ago. And it is pretty outstanding, and I'm going to tell you why, because the engraving came out absolutely perfect. And we were looking for, I don't know when 14 karat gold made it to, it had to be 14 karat gold, or it had to have the symbol of sterling. But this is dated June 1895, and it's, of all things, St. Patrick's Academy.
Oh.
And it looks like a Medal of Honor. And it looks like it says C-O-N-G on, and then I'm believing North Dakota because it's N period, D period. The person's name is clearly identified on the back as whoever she is, Miss Whatever, and it says for excellence. And it's encased in what I would call gold leaf leaves, and it's just an outstanding little piece. And I'm just wondering, because it doesn't say 14 karat gold on it, it's a very light piece, and again, it's only 1 inch by 1 inch. It's just a pretty cool looking piece, and I'm wondering what you think.
Sure. So we see lots of. It's always been popular to recognize achievements, you know, whether it's in, you know, kids in high school or college or, you know, athletic competitive events,
right,
or get-togethers at conventions or, you know, sales milestones in a big company. This type of thing was very popular in the late 19th and early 20th century, and we see lots of these types of medals. Typically, the solid gold ones were reserved for, you know, the, you know, leaders of industry, really more prestigious awards and prizes. But what you see a lot of are, what we see a lot of are items that are gold filled. So gold filled is a, it's what they would do is they would take a sheet of brass and sandwich it between two very thin sheets of gold, you know, solder them together, and then machine things, make things out of that. So you wound up with a layer of gold that was much thicker than it would be through a simple, you know, gold electroplating process. So the, if it looks gold and it doesn't say 14 karat, it's most likely that it's gold filled, which can still be anywhere from 1 to 3% gold. So it has some gold content in it. But it's less likely that it's going to be solid 14 karat or 10 karat or 18 karat gold. Some of them, to save a little money, might have been done in 10 karat gold, which is just, you know, the, you know, 40 something percent gold instead of the 50 something percent gold that 14 karat is. But most likely it's gold filled, and most of these are interesting but not particularly valuable unless they're related to an institution or a person of historical importance. Sometimes people collect things from that period, maybe from Yale or Harvard, or it might have been, you know, somebody that, you know, was noteworthy through being a politician or, you know, achieving some high rank in the army. There has to be a historical dimension of some sort for it, things like this, to have significant value if they're not made out of, you know, precious metals.
Linda, thank you very much for the call. Mark Lawson joins us today, and Mike is in Gansevoort. Mike, you're on.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Sure.
My dad passed away, and he left. He saved a lot of coins.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, silver dollars and half dollars and Susan B. Anthony's, and he has bags of them. But I was looking online, and it said that Susan B. Anthony's, the value would be worth $2, and a lot of the, he has some silver, but some of the ones that aren't silver, the older Kennedys and Eisenhowers, that they were worth $5 and such.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
For most of the circulated cupronickel Eisenhower dollars and Susan B. Anthony dollars, it is not correct. They, most of the time, they're just worth their face value, which is to say a dollar. I regularly take bunches of those to the bank to cash in for clients, and or, you know, I send clients that come in for an evaluation back home with them to cash them in themselves. If they're in mint packaging, like as they, some of these were issued in special editions for the, you know, to sell to collectors at the time that they were made, those can be worth a little bit more. But mostly when you're seeing those prices on the internet, it's mostly, it's more from retailers that are hoping that, somebody will sell, they'll be able to sell things for that much, or to, you know, give some, an idea that the, that's a good price for somebody that they've already sold the things to. So it's,
that's a very big help. Very much.
I beg your pardon?
He said that's a very big help. Well, Mike.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you're welcome. It's a good question, and I get it all the time.
Let's go to Kathy in Boston Spa. Hello, Kathy.
Hello. So I have two binders filled with plastic sleeves, each about 3 inches thick, filled with baseball cards from the late 70s. And I'm just, and they came out of the package and they went into these sleeves. So are they worth keeping? Are they worth, you know, trying to find somebody to look at them, or should I just?
Well, I'm glad you called. Interestingly, you know, for years, baseball cards from that period were kind of in a collecting slump. You know, part of it was, you know, in the 1980s and 90s especially, they really jumped into mass producing lots of baseball cards. And at the same time that there was a decrease in demand, and we've certainly seen that, you know, in the last 20 years, much less interest in collecting anything, even baseball cards. What we're seeing now, though, which is kind of cool, is a resurgence in interest in the baseball cards from these years that were less cared about in the past. So they may have some good value, or at least they may have. They used to be worth, you know, very, very little, you know, say 15 or 20 years ago. And I think that has begun to change. So probably in part because of the younger people. I feel like an old guy, but people that what happens an awful lot of times in collecting is, you know, people usually collect things out of a sense of nostalgia or, you know, sentimentality, remembering things from grandma's or even remembering things that they collected. And I think as you have a population of maybe guys that were, you know, 8 or 10 or 12 in the 1970s get the old, you know, age, be, you know, maybe more having become more successful in their careers and life and having some money. Now they're older, they have some money, and they're starting to collect these things. So I think that's part of what's going on. You have a new demographic interest in this kind of material, so which is great news for you, because it's I know this kind of material is, it may not be worth a fortune, but it's worth it's going to be worth significantly more today than it was, as I said, you know, 15 or 20 years ago.
Remember, Kathy, and hey, we'll do a baseball
card in the binders.
We'll do a baseball card show or a comic show soon. But one thing to remember is you're looking for rookie cards, so. Hold on to those.
Okay.
Hold on to those, because they all might be.
I will do that. Thank you.
90% of them might be worth nothing, and then you might find that one. So be careful. And,
but I might have that one. That'd be great.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. All right. We have 1 minute left.
Thanks, Kathy.
With Mark Lawson. Let's go to. Oh, he's on a rocket ship to the moon. Tegan, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi there. Hey, I have a little thrift store, and we get just a whole bunch of vintage this, antique that, from jewelry to paintings to just all kinds of stuff. And I'm trying to figure out, since I'm not really educated in the industry, is there a simple way, a basic way, other than just eBay, to go find a generic value? Because I sold a lot of things for $10 and $15 and then was educated. Yeah, that was worth about $2,000.
Ah.
I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah. All right, we have 30 seconds here, Mark Lawson.
Traditionally, the most effective thing to do is create an informal partnership with somebody knowledgeable that you can vet things with, that will steer you in the right direction, give you recommendations, help you sell things that you can, you know, shoot images to or call about things, and they'll give you some good feedback. That's the conventional solution to your problem.
Great. Have you heard of WorthPoint?
WorthPoint.
Worth Point. Yeah, it's one of the several sites that track sales records online. You may get and I'm not saying it's bad, it's expensive, and you may get good information. You may want to look at just completed auctions on eBay, which will cost you nothing, and again, you want to look at actual sales results, not asking prices, and that'll That'll get you a good chunk of the way towards Worth Point without having to pay for it.
Mark Lawson, we are done, sir. Thank you so much for being here. Have a great rest of your St. Paddy's Day, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
You too, Ray. It's been a pleasure.
Support comes from the Center for Disability Services, thanking their staff who are working to help people with their life skills during these challenging times. CFDSNY.org/careers for information about helping others. New Abode LLC, combining new technology with agents using a hands-on approach to help walk their customers through the real estate process from start to finish. New-abode.com. And the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, supporting the community with a temporary closure and continuing to explore art and ideas online. For projects and resources, skidmore.edu/tang. Thanks again to Mark Lawson for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Melissa Keys answered the phones. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's the Science Farm.